Good day. Today is Wednesday, 15th October 2025. And before turning to the topics I'm going to discuss in this video, let me remind you again to tick the like button if, after having watched or listened to the video, or those parts of the video that you want to watch or listen to, you have liked what you have heard. Now, let me return now to the topics that I'm going to discuss in this program. And let me first of all begin by saying that it seems to me that over the last 24 hours, we have seen in the West an increasing retreat into unreality on all sorts of topics, which I'm just going to briefly touch upon. Firstly, there continues to be, in my opinion, an extraordinary misreading of the situation in the Middle East, and in particular in connection with the Gaza ceasefire. Now, yesterday, for a short time, Reuters, the British news agency, published a piece, an article, about how the current Gaza ceasefire was in doubt. It mentioned how Hamas forces had resurfaced and were moving visibly and openly around Gaza, and how there'd been negative reactions from that in Israel. So far, there's been no news that the ceasefire in Gaza has actually collapsed. But I have to say that I am generally concerned that it probably will collapse, because the premise upon which the whole ceasefire in Gaza is being reported, it seems to me, is straightforwardly wrong. It is being reported as if Israel and the United States, by extension, have gained some great victory in Gaza. And as of now, I don't see any evidence of that at all. To repeat again, Hamas is still there. It still appears to have control in Gaza, and its armed forces continue to function and perhaps remain intact. Its tunnel network still exists. Its armories are still there. And apparently it has succeeded in recruiting more fighters. Now, if there is going to be an introduction into Gaza of a peacekeeping force drawn from the Arab states, and if Hamas is still in existence when that peacekeeping force arrives, then it seems to me that the balance of advantage in this conflict will have been clearly in Hamas's favour. Of course, one cannot be certain. One doesn't know exactly what the peacekeeping force will do. And we've had situations in the Middle East where peacekeeping forces have been deployed, for example, to southern Lebanon, and have proved completely ineffective. The fact that there might be Arab and Muslim troops based in Gaza does not mean necessarily that a restart of the conflict there will not take place. We've had, as I've said, peacekeeping forces in southern Lebanon, and that has not prevented fighting taking place between the Israeli Defense Forces and Hezbollah, and these battles, this fighting, can take place on a regular basis. But having said all of that, to repeat again, even if some kind of technocratic government is established to administer Gaza, and by the way, Hamas has said that it does not object to that, if Hamas retains its organization, its physical presence in Gaza, its militia forces, and at least some, and perhaps most of its weapons, and its ability to make weapons, which it apparently can do, then the goal that the Israeli government set itself when it began military operations in Gaza in October 2023 will not have been achieved. And that falls far short of an Israeli victory, however that is defined. And I would argue that if anything, the advantage would clearly be in Hamas's favour. Now, I struggle to believe that the current government of Israel is going to be satisfied with such an outcome. And that is why I myself have serious doubts that this particular ceasefire will remain in effect for very long. Now, I say all of this because I read every day articles in the media in Europe and in the United States which speak about the conflict in Gaza as having ended. I wish I was sure of that, but for the reasons I have just set out, I am not. And given the problems, it does seem to me that the media rhetoric, the discussions that are taking place about the situation in the Middle East are beginning to acquire an increasing quality of unreality. Returning now to the process whereby this conflict, the fighting in Gaza, was brought to an end, I'm going to say that there is also, for me, a significant unreality about the meeting that took place in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, which was addressed, of course, by the President of the United States, Donald Trump. The President, at this meeting, appeared to waive an agreement that he said had been reached between the Israelis and Hamas to end the fighting in Gaza. Well, I hope that agreement is real, but I would point out that neither Israel nor Hamas were present or represented at this meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh. As far as I'm aware, Prime Minister Netanyahu was not there, nor were any officials of his government. And of course, there were no representatives of Hamas there either. It is a very strange agreement where the signing ceremony, or at least the concluding ceremony, the ceremony at which the agreement is announced, takes place without the presence of the people who are supposed to have been involved in agreeing that particular agreement. And I noticed that one other important person also does not seem to have been present at this meeting, and that is the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, who is also the Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia, and the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Apparently, he didn't turn up. And again, there's no satisfactory explanation as to why that might have been the case. But I do wonder whether he has doubts about the viability and the longevity of this process. Now, as to why it has happened, why we have had this sudden cessation of hostilities, there is a general consensus that the point where the United States decided that the fighting in Gaza had to be brought to an end came with the Israeli strike in Qatar on the building where the Hamas negotiators were believed to be. Apparently this shocked and infuriated not just the Emir of Qatar and his officials, but also all of the other Gulf states. And apparently the United States, the president himself, Donald Trump, were dismayed by what happened and infuriated by the fact that the Israelis carried out this strike, supposedly without getting American permission in advance, and that it was this that was for the United States the final straw, and which made the United States decide that the conflict in Gaza had to be brought to an immediate end. Well, I'm not going to push back on that, but I'm going to simply say that, in my opinion, that is certainly an inadequate explanation. And it's been obvious to me anyway for some time that the pressure to bring the conflict to an end in Gaza was increasing in the Middle East and with an increasing number of moves in the United Nations and in the General Assembly especially. More and more European governments, including the British and French government, have now recognised the need for a Palestinian state and have given formal recognition to that state. And I suspect that if events had continued as they were before the ceasefire was brought into effect, there would have been a vote at some point in the General Assembly at which the Palestinian state, headed by the Palestinian Authority, in turn headed by the President of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, would have been granted a full seat and representation in the United Nations General Assembly. The United States does not favour that outcome, and certainly the current president does not do so either. But anyway, the pressure for that was undoubtedly increasing, and I suspect that played a role, as was the increasingly embarrassing position in which European governments found themselves and in which the President of the United States also found himself, as it became increasingly clear that sections of his electoral base were starting to rebel against the policy of unequivocal support for Israel in this conflict. So the trends to move towards a ceasefire were probably already there before the strike on Qatar took place. I'm not saying that that had no part to play in this, but I remain sceptical, for one thing, whether it was indeed the case that the United States was genuinely uninformed about that strike. Anyway, regardless, one can see how the pressures in the United States were sufficiently great that a decision to achieve a ceasefire at this particular time might have become compelling, and that might have caused the United States, the administration, to tell the Israeli government, Prime Minister Netanyahu, to stop. But if that is correct, then it also follows that as these same pressures abate, we have every possibility that we will return to conflict again. If the ceasefire is the product of pressures of the moment, political pressures of the moment, be they coming from the Arab world, European publics, the MAGA base in the United States, as soon as those pressures reduce, there's every chance that we will go back to the default positions that we saw previously and which have dominated policy since October 2023, which is for conflict in the Middle East. So this is what I wanted to say about this topic. It's probably the last thing I'm going to say about this topic for a while. When and if, I hope it is, it doesn't happen, but when and if fighting resumes, which, as I said, I would much rather not see, then obviously I will return to this topic further. Alternatively, if peacekeeping forces are finally introduced into Gaza, then that will also be an important event And obviously, I will return to this topic then. But until that either of these eventualities take place, I'm going to leave this topic for the moment. Anyway, let's now return to other things. And let us first of all discuss the situation in Ukraine. Now, yesterday, Radovka, the Russian newspaper based in Smolensk, which, as I've discussed many times, is clearly on the nationalist side of the Russian political spectrum, and which is clearly extremely well informed about the conflict in Ukraine and about the situation on the battlefields. So well informed, in fact, that I personally believe that it is being regularly briefed by the Russian military leadership about the situation in Ukraine. Anyway, Radovka finally confirmed, I say confirmed, because I don't believe that they have come to this conclusion by themselves. Anyway, they finally confirmed what I have gradually come round to believing is indeed the case, which is that the Russians have a plan, and that plan in Donbass is to encircle the remaining Ukrainian forces in Donbass in the two cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. In other words, to create in Donbass a cauldron, not a small cauldron, but a massive cauldron of the entire Ukrainian army that has been holding out in Donbass. And I don't know the size of this army, but I'm going to guess that we're talking about tens upon tens of thousands of men. And it is not difficult to see how this can be playing out. And Radovka spoke about pincers that are now closing around the Ukrainian forces. One pincer is located in the south, in Pokrovsk, and northeast of Pokrovsk, in the area of the Russian breakthrough. And that pincer is starting to turn the Ukrainian defense line along the row of cities, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, and Konstantinovka, which remains the major defense line that the Ukrainians have in Donbass. And the other pincer is located in the north. And this pincer is perhaps rather less developed, but it involves the capture of the towns of Kupiansk, Siversk, Liman, and eventually Izium and Balaklaya. Izium and Balaklaya, previously controlled by the Russians in 2022 for several months in 2022, recaptured by the Ukrainians in September and October 2022, under Ukrainian control since then, but increasingly threatened by the Russians as the situation in the north, in these other places, Kupiansk, Liman, and Siversk, starts, the Ukrainian position in these places starts to crumble. Now, it is actually not difficult to understand this prospective encirclement and why people are talking about it. Because the supply roads, the roads and the railway lines to the cities of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, and perhaps one should add Konstantinovka as well, come from two routes. One is from the north, and it passes through Izium, which has been called the gateway into the Donbass. This has been the main transport hub leading to these cities in the Donbass from the north. And the other was Pokrovsk, which provides another separate cluster of roads and railway lines leading into these cities in the Donbass from the south. If the Russians capture Pokrovsk, and they're very close to doing so now, in fact, closer than many people in the West perhaps understand, and I will come to that later. If the Russians capture Pokrovsk, the entry points to the cities, the supply routes to the cities from the south is lost. If the Russians capture Izium, then the supply routes to these cities from the north is also lost. There are no other strong supply routes. There are obviously roads that lead from these towns westwards to the Dnieper, but they are not as complex or as developed as the roads to the north. And importantly, if the Russians control Pokrovsk, they are anyway in a position to outflank these cities by advancing from Pokrovsk northward, positioning themselves to the west of these cities and cutting off their communications from the west as well. At which point we would have an effective encirclement, a cauldron, and any Ukrainian troops still in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk and perhaps Konstantinovka, if it has not already fallen, would at that point be surrounded and cut off from resupply. Now, way back in 2022, right at the start of the special military operation on the Duran, we discussed the military situation many times, and we spoke about the possible plan of the Russians to create a cauldron for the Ukrainian forces in Donbass. At that time, we assumed that the Russians would achieve that within a few months. It has taken them very, very much longer. And the reasons for this are manifold. Firstly, the Russian forces that advanced into Ukraine in February 2022 were relatively few in number. People estimate them at between 150,000 and 200,000 men, and that was nowhere near enough. And the Russian advance into Ukraine was anyway complicated by the diplomatic games that Vladimir Putin was playing at that time. His objective was not, it seems, to obtain a military victory over Ukraine, but rather to negotiate a compromise with President Zelensky, in which, it's important to say, Putin almost succeeded with the Istanbul Agreement that appeared to have been initialed by the two sides in April 2022, but which quickly unraveled. Anyway, the lack of troops on the Russian side and the fact that the Russians were pursuing diplomatic outcomes as opposed to military ones, with ceasefires being announced on several occasions and talks underway in Belarus and Turkey, made it impossible for the Russians to conduct an encirclement operation in Donbass at that time. In addition, the Ukrainians themselves, throughout the same period, conducted a massive mobilization, and by the summer they had several hundred thousand men under arms. So Zelensky himself claimed that the total force that Ukraine was fielding in the summer of 2022 numbered almost 1 million men. I was sceptical about that number at the time, but it is one that most people today accept. Well, the result was that the Ukrainians, by the summer of 2022, substantially, perhaps multiple times, outnumbered the Russians making any encirclement operation impossible. The third factor, which prolonged the war, and prolonged the war significantly, was Western military help. And this clearly was on a scale that the Russians themselves in 2022 perhaps had not anticipated. And here we have to talk about the unending supplies of advanced weapons of the West. Firstly, in 2022, mostly stockpiles of ex-Soviet weapons in Eastern Europe. But then we also started to see M777 howitzers, HIMARS multiple launch rocket systems. Then in late 2022, the decision was taken to start providing armoured vehicles, Leopard 2 tanks, ARAM tanks, Challenger tanks, infantry fighting vehicles from Germany, Marders and Bradleys, and all of these, and of course artillery and other things. And there was also massive intelligence assistance provided to Ukraine, and gradually American officers became increasingly involved in commanding Ukrainian military operations. And what the Russians perhaps initially imagined would be a conflict between themselves and Ukraine, by the autumn of 2022 had clearly evolved into a proxy war between the Russians and NATO, or, as I prefer to say, rather a coalition war in which NATO and Ukraine together were fighting the Russians. And the Russians have had to overcome all of that, and that has meant massively increasing production of weapons and calling up many more men. And they started doing that with a call up in the autumn of 2022 of 300,000 men. That was an actual conscription. But then since then, there's been massive recruitment by the Russian army, which has steadily increased in size to the point where probably this year, the Russians have finally overtaken the Ukrainian army in size and now have surpassed it significantly as Ukrainian losses have mounted and Russian reinforcements have increased. So it has taken the Russians much longer to achieve, to bring themselves to the point of seriously contemplating an encirclement operation in Donbass than we on the Duran imagined in 2022. But it seems that they are now almost there. It's starting to feature in their plans. It is on their planning horizon. And we're starting to see that Russian commentators, Radovka and others, are starting to talk about this as a realistic option. Now, there remains an awful lot still to do. Firstly, Pokrovsk has still not fully fallen. The fighting in Pokrovsk continues, and there have been many more reports about the situation in Pokrovsk over the last couple of hours. Firstly, it is clear that the Russians have now cleared all remaining Ukrainian positions east and probably south of Mirnograd, the eastern suburb of Pokrovsk, and that they have actually broken into Mirnograd itself, and that fighting is indeed taking place inside Mirnograd, the southern part of Mirnograd. And it's been suggested that if the Russians are able to capture the southern positions of Mirnograd, then they would be in a position to advance northward over open country between Mirnograd and Pokrovsk itself. until they reach a lightly built-up area which connects Pokrovsk with Mirnograd, lightly built-up, but not perhaps difficult to break through. And if the Russians capture this area, then Mirnograd and Pokrovsk will be cut off from each other, and the situation in Mirnograd will become critical for any Ukrainian defenders who are still there. In fact, it has been suggested that the Ukrainians, before that point is reached, would probably have no realistic option but to retreat from Mirnograd and abandon it entirely to the Russians and instead to relocate to Pokrovsk. Now, if this is correct, and bear in mind I'm not somebody who's either personally on the ground and therefore able to assess the territory, and as I have no background in military affairs anyway, I'm probably not the best person to assess the territory either. But anyway, if this is correct, then, well, it could be the case that the battle for Mirnograd will not be a particularly prolonged one. I said in a recent program that Mirnograd was a relatively newly developed suburb of Pokrovsk, so that there are large numbers of high-rise buildings there. But if it is completely encircled and cut off from resupply, then it might be difficult for the Ukrainians to put up much resistance. And of course, if they pull out to avoid encirclement, then the problem of storming these high-rise buildings might not even exist at all. At which point, the Ukrainians would only be holding territory in some eastern and central areas of Pokrovsk itself. They would be deeply compressed in a relatively small area. And as I have discussed again in recent programs, the supply roads to Pokrovsk itself are effectively cut off. The Ukrainians are not able to send supplies down these roads. Rodinska to the north of Pokrovsk looks like it is being stormed, and there are now increasing numbers of reports that appear to confirm that the Ukrainian forces in Rodinska are encircled and that the Russians control the southern areas of Rodinska and perhaps stretches of the road that passes through Rodinska to the south, and that the Russians also appear to be making significant inroads west of Pokrovsk towards the Ukrainian defence positions there. There continue to be claims that the Russians have captured the Pokrovska mine to the west of Pokrovsk, for example, and that is not absolutely confirmed. I haven't seen any pictures of Russian soldiers raising flags there, but it might be true. Anyway, that the Russians, anyway, have enough control in this area to cut the supply roads into Pokrovsk from the west as well, and that they are supposedly in the process of storming the industrial area to the northwest of Pokrovsk. So if the Ukrainians retreat from Mirnograd into central western Pokrovsk, their position in that area will be catastrophic. And again, one wonders how long they could hold out, and there might eventually be a breakout attempt, but it's debatable whether such a breakout attempt would be successful for large numbers of the Ukrainian troops who are trapped there. Now, there's been a number of maps that have been published by a number of people comparing the situation in Pokrovsk to the situation in Avdiivka in the weeks before Avdiivka's fall in February 2024. And certainly the two maps look in many respects very similar. You see Pokrovsk, like Avdiivka, taken into a semicircle of territory fully under Russian control, with the Russians controlling large stretches of Pokrovsk, as they did Avdiivka. Except I think that there are nonetheless differences. Firstly, Pokrovsk is much bigger than Avdiivka was. That is one. But secondly, it seems to me that the roads leading out of Avdiivka were still much more accessible to the Ukrainians than the roads leading out of Pokrovsk are. So the operational crisis that the Ukrainians face in Pokrovsk is arguably both more severe and much greater in scale than was the case in Avdiivka in February 2024. And Avdiivka was a place of very great strategic significance. Its fall shocked the Ukrainians. It was supposed to be the strongest position on the Ukrainian lines. There was lots of claims that the Russians would fail to capture it. There was lots of boasting, as I remember, that the first Russian assaults on Avdiivka had been unsuccessful, and that lulled many people in the West into a forced sense of complacency, until the moment suddenly came when resistance in Avdiivka collapsed. But however important Avdiivka was, it is not as strategically significant as Pokrovsk is, because Pokrovsk, unlike Avdiivka, is not situated on top of all of these key supply lines and is not situated in a way, was not situated in a way, unlike Pokrovsk, whereby the Russians would be able to outflank other Ukrainian positions in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk further to the north. So a defeat, a disaster for the Ukrainians in Pokrovsk will be much more important and far more significant than what took place in Avdiivka almost 2 years ago. So anyway, that's just a general point to make about the Battle of Pokrovsk. We are probably still some weeks from the final conclusion. Perhaps it will come around the end of the year or early next year. Who knows? But one can see the trends starting to develop. The Ukrainian counterattacks northeast of Pokrovsk have been unsuccessful, and the ring around the city is tightening. And as I said, its fall will be very, very consequential in ways which I suspect even the Ukrainians will not, in the end, be able to deny. Now, the other part of the pincer, as Radovka calls it, is more complicated. We're talking about battles for three towns, Kupiansk, Liman and Siversk, and none of them has the strategic importance that Pokrovsk has in the south. But the fall of each one of these places, or all of these places, is important because it arguably leads to the eventual recapture of the town that really matters here, which is Izium. And Izium, much smaller place than Pokrovsk, but also a major transport and railway hub, and its capture closes off the supply lines to the, as I said, to the Ukrainians in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, in the same way that the fall of Pokrovsk closes the routes for the Ukrainians to reach Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, to send supplies to Slavyansk, Kramatorsk from the south. Now, here there's been some important news over the last 24 hours. The various mapping projects have now coloured the entire central region of Kupiansk under Russian control, and there have been reports from the Ukrainians that this has indeed happened. In other words, that the area that had been surrounded by the Russians, but which was still under Ukrainian control in the residential part of Kupiansk, which is located on the west bank of the Oskol River, has now passed fully under Russian control. It has been suggested that the Ukrainian troops there fled and escaped, and that this is why the Russians have been able to occupy this territory. That could be true, and to a certain extent, it is likely that it is true. However, I read that the actual number of Ukrainian troops on this territory in central Kupiansk numbered no more than about 700 men. So it seems to be equally possible that the Russians have flushed them out and perhaps killed or captured most of them. Anyway, central Kupiansk is now, and there seems to be a general consensus about this, under Russian control. The Ukrainians still control some parts of Kupiansk on the west bank of the Oskol, but these are well to the south, and I understand that they're the usual micro-districts that are not part of the main residential metropolitan area of Kupiansk. The major battle in Kupiansk concerns the situation in the industrial area, sector of Kupiansk, the factory area, which is located on the east bank of the Oskol River. This is where the Ukrainians had concentrated a significant number of their forces, several brigades by most accounts, and where they had been involved in a long and complex battle trying to block the Russians from advancing upon Kupiansk from the east, clearing the territory to the east bank of the Oskol River. The Ukrainians apparently assuming that the main attack on Kupiansk would come from this direction. Instead, what happened was that the Russians crossed the Oskol River well to the north of Kupiansk, gradually enlarged their bridgehead, and eventually attacked Kupiansk, the western part of Kupiansk, on the west bank of the Oskol River. A part of the residential part of Kupiansk, I should also say, is also on higher ground than the industrial part of Kupiansk, which is on the east bank of the Oskol River. Anyway, the Russians attacked and stormed Kupiansk from a completely different direction than the one that the Ukrainians apparently expected. And for reasons which I do not understand, but which are likely connected with Zelensky's and Syrsky's inability to retreat their forces from positions that they hold, the Ukrainians, even as these Russian bridgeheads west of the Oskol River grew and grew in size, did not withdraw their forces from the east bank of the Oskol River, where they are now trapped. Now, again, it's difficult to say exactly how long this battle will go on for and what is going to happen to these troops. But at some point, resistance by the Ukrainians, these Ukrainian forces east of the Oskol River, is going to collapse, if only because they're going to run out of supplies. And probably there will again be an attempt to escape, people trying to perhaps swim across the Oskol River, or who knows what exactly. But this very complicated battle for Kupiansk is coming to an end. And it is coming to an end for the Ukrainians in an especially disastrous way, with losses of men and machines much greater than perhaps ought to have been the case. Anyway, Kupiansk itself is undoubtedly important, but the Russians also have to capture the other two places, Siversk and Liman. And these places, of course, are located to the south and east. They need to capture these two places before they capture the advance on Izium itself. And here, well, the Russians are now claiming that there's fighting going on in Siversk and that they're in the process of storming the villages of Dronivka and Yampol to the west of Siversk. And it looks as if those battles are indeed underway. And it does indeed start, it is indeed starting to look as if Siversk will probably also fall again, probably at some point within the next maybe 2-3 weeks, perhaps sooner than that. There is always a chance that the collapse, when it comes, will come more suddenly than is expected. Liman, which is a bigger place than Siversk had a pre-war population of around 10,000. Liman had a pre-war population of around 20,000 and is a more spread out town. The battle there has not started, but again, the Russians seem to have cleared all of the villages around Liman, except one, which is a village called Drobyshevka, and it looks as if that particular village is currently being stormed as well. So it is likely that a Russian advance into Liman will also take place at some point over the next couple of days. One way or the other, all three of these towns, Kupiansk, Siversk, Liman, are likely to fall over the next couple of weeks or months, and that will then open the way for the Russians to advance to Izium. Now, the Ukrainians do seem to have some sense of all of this. Apparently, the civilian authorities in Slavyansk have proposed to the civilian population that they all leave, so that some kind of civilian evacuation from Slavyansk might take place, or perhaps is taking place. And that suggests a general understanding of the Ukrainian, on the part of the Ukrainian authorities, that there is an evolving crisis in Donbass. And there's also been reports over the last 24 hours that the Ukrainians have ordered a compulsory evacuation of civilians from 27 villages north of Kupiansk in Kharkiv region. Now, when the Russian Defense Ministry discussed the options that the Russian army has in the event that Kupiansk is captured, they did talk about an advance on Izium and about the eventual capture of Izium leading to the capture of Slavyansk. But they also talked about a potential advance northwards towards the city of Kharkiv itself via the town of Chuguyev, which lies immediately south of Kharkiv, north of Kupiansk. Now, the key thing here is that not only is Kupiansk falling, but it looks as if further north still, another place which has been fought over for a very long time, Volchansk, is now also almost entirely under Russian control. The battle of Volchansk has been incredibly protracted. The Russians reached Volchansk in May of last year. The Ukrainians then committed pretty much every force that they could to Volchansk, tried to hold back the Russians there. And then in August of last year, Zelensky ordered his Kursk counteroffensive, and the Russians had to draw forces from Volchansk in order to hold back the Ukrainians in Kursk. And the result was that the Battle of Volchansk went into a kind of suspense for many months. But over the last few weeks, the Russians have reactivated it. And some time ago, several weeks ago, they cleared all of Volchansk north of the Volcha River, and they crossed the Volcha River itself, and they now have captured most of Volchansk south of the Volcha River, except again for certain outlying suburbs, micro-districts, apparently disconnected from the main town, that lie some distance to the south. But it seems that the Russians are pushing towards these places as well. And again, it is likely that they will fall. And the assumption is that at some point, Russian forces will advance north from Kupiansk and south from Volchansk, and that they will meet, and that a large chunk of Kharkiv region will come under Russian control, and that this will also in turn open the way for an attack on Kharkiv. Well, I'm not going to speculate too far about this. It could be that the Russians do have that plan. They like to stretch the Ukrainian defences. But coming back to what Radovka has been saying, and others like Marat Khairulin have been saying, I think the Russian priority, once Kupiansk, Liman and Siversk fall, will be to capture Izium and the town that lies immediately, some distance in fact, to the west of Izium, but which is needed to cover Izium, which is Balaklaya. And then, even as the Russians continue their advance from the south, from Pokrovsk, outflanking the Ukrainians in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk from the west, then, as I said, the cauldron that I've been talking about will start to happen. Now, again, I don't want to give a timeline for this. I don't have one. I suspect that the Russian general staff does. I get the clear sense, especially now, reading the various reports and analysis of the situation on the battlefield that Marat Khairulin especially has been publishing, that the Russians not only have an overall plan, but that they do have a timeline to execute the various parts of the plan. And, well, obviously, things might take longer than the Russians themselves expect. There is always the possibility of things going differently than the Russians themselves expect or imagine. But I think that I have outlined what I suspect the Russian plan is with a reasonable degree of accuracy. I say this because the Russians themselves are now increasingly openly commenting and talking about it as if this is indeed the plan that they intend to execute. A strategic encirclement of the Ukrainian forces in Donbass, the creation of a major cauldron for the Ukrainian forces there, the destruction, in other words, of the Ukrainian army, the main part of the Ukrainian army east of the Dnieper. Anyway, all of this takes place even as in the West people continue to discuss and argue about the war and talk about continuing to support Ukraine. Over the course of today, I understand that no fewer than three meetings are taking place. Three meetings are taking place in Brussels talking about how to continue to provide support for Ukraine. What is extraordinary about these meetings is that all three agencies of the collective West, organizations of the collective West in Europe, are simultaneously engaged and participating in these meetings. So NATO is involved, so is the European Union, and so is the Council of Europe, apparently. All three of them are meeting and talking and discussing with each other what they're all going to do to support Ukraine. Now, prior to these meetings taking place, there was a report that was circulating yesterday that the US ambassador to NATO, Matthew Whitaker, who comes across very much as a hardliner, had apparently said that today there would be a major announcement concerning US military aid to Ukraine. Well, that report circulated for several hours. I never found or saw Whitaker's exact words, and in the last few hours that has been walked back. According to the latest claims, Whitaker did not say that the United States was going to announce some major new military program for Ukraine. He apparently instead spoke about the kind of discussions that would take place over the course of these three meetings, all of which are taking place in Brussels. And, it doesn't seem actually as if much of substance is going to come out of these meetings. Now, I say much of substance. There's been some reports that over the course of these meetings, some kind of agreement is going to be hammered out to loosen restrictions on NATO air forces to shoot down Russian planes if they trespass into NATO airspace. But even this is unclear. And, well, again, I have to say this, for the moment at least, it looks as if these three meetings are all going to be mostly talking shops. Now, simultaneously with that meeting, these meetings in Brussels, Zelensky himself is supposedly going to turn up in the United States, and he's going to have another meeting with Donald Trump. Now, here perhaps it's worth making a point about Zelensky's movements, because it seems that he is still able to travel out of Kiev. Now, for some time now, since 2022, in fact, it has been impossible to fly in and out of Kiev. The Russians control the airspace, and the airspace over Ukraine is considered dangerous for civilian airliners. So if Zelensky leaves Kiev, he must do so by train. And over the last few weeks, the Russians have been attacking the railway lines and have been disrupting railway traffic across Ukraine. Incidentally, last night, despite the fact that there doesn't seem to have been a combined drone and missile attack on Kiev over the course of the night, despite that, there was a major blackout which lasted many hours in Kiev. Apparently, after the repeated Russian strikes, the energy system is now at such level of overstretch that it simply broke down, and much of Kiev was left without power. Anyway, my point is that despite the Russian attacks on the railway lines, Zelensky still apparently feels able and safe to leave Kiev by train and travel to meet his friends in Europe and in the United States. Now, the Russians have a very clear idea of Zelensky's whereabouts, and he undoubtedly knows that they have a very clear idea of his whereabouts. There must be at least a tacit understanding still in place that the Russians will not attack his train. So he feels able to leave Kiev, safe in the knowledge that he is not in danger when he does so. Now, that is an interesting fact in itself, and it highlights again the extraordinary restraint that the Russians continue to show in many respects in terms of their conduct of the war. Anyway, Zelensky is apparently heading to Washington, and apparently he's going to have a meeting with Trump. Now, he's recently had two long telephone conversations with Trump, one after the other. And over the course of those telephone conversations, he apparently badgered Trump to supply Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. And Trump himself has indicated that he fully expects Zelensky to come to Washington demanding and asking for Tomahawk missiles. Now, there's been a long article about this in the Financial Times, and I think this article has been somewhat misunderstood or misreported in some places, because the article has been reported as suggesting that the United States has made a decision to supply Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, but it intends to supply only 20 to 50 of these missiles. If you actually read the article itself, and its title is Donald Trump to meet Volodymyr Zelensky in Washington on Friday, if you actually read the article itself, you see that there are comments from Ukrainian officials in which they admit that no decision to supply Tomahawk missiles by the United States to Ukraine has in fact been made. The topic is still under discussion. Zelensky continues to push for the missiles to be supplied, but Trump has not yet made a formal decision to supply them, and perhaps has not made any kind of decision to supply them. Secondly, the point about 20 to 50 missiles being supplied does not come from an official US source. It comes from a military commentator, somebody who is familiar with the total numbers of the US stockpile of Tomahawk missiles, and who has assessed how many the United States might be able to afford to give Ukraine. I'm going to just read this section of the article. Mark Hankian, a former Pentagon official, now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, estimated in a recent war game that the United States had 4,150 Tomahawks in total. Just over 4,000, in other words. Less, in fact, than most estimates that I have read until now, but quite likely true. Just over 4,000 Tomahawk missiles. And we then go on to read, and this is the Financial Times again, and it's clearly explaining now the opinion of Mark Hankian. However, the United States would probably be able to supply only a few to Ukraine. This is in light of the fact that out of the 200 the Pentagon has procured since 2022, it has already fired more than 120, according to defense experts. The Defense Department has requested funding for only 57 more Tomahawks in its 2026 budget. Washington would probably also need Tomahawks for any strike on Venezuela. An interesting comment there, that Venezuela is likely to be attacked fairly soon, probably with Tomahawk missiles, and the United States, which only has 4,000 of these missiles in its inventory, is going to need perhaps several hundred of them to attack Venezuela. And then we read Stacy Pettijohn, director of the defense program at the Center for a New American Security think tank, said Washington could spare some 20 to 50 Tomahawks for Ukraine, which will not decisively shift the dynamics of the war. And this is where the figure of 20 to 50 Tomahawk missiles potentially supplied by the United States to Ukraine comes from. It does not come from the US government. It comes from Stacy Pettijohn. But Stacy Pettijohn is one of two experts consulted by the Financial Times. The other expert is Mark Kankian, and he also believes that only a small number of Tomahawks can be supplied to Ukraine, though he doesn't give a number. The point is that the inventory is relatively small. I come back to what I was saying in previous programs. Apparently around 1,000 of these missiles, of these 4,000 missiles, are designed for use with nuclear warheads and cannot therefore be supplied to Ukraine. A significant proportion of the 3,000 remaining are for use by US Navy submarines, and they too are unsuitable for supply to Ukraine. They cannot be adapted to Ukrainian needs. I don't know what the number of these is. That leaves around 2,000 for the US surface fleet, the Aegis class destroyers. And, well, given the fact that these missiles are launched in salvos of dozens or scores of these missiles at a time, that means that the numbers of Tomahawk missiles, that the inventory is relatively small, there is no active replenishment of it, and that leaves only a very small number of missiles available to send to Ukraine. Now, this makes complete logical sense, but of course it assumes that the United States, that the US government, that Donald Trump, is going to let the mere question of the size of the American inventory deter them from supplying large numbers of these missiles to Ukraine. One could have made exactly the same case about the ATACMS. The ATACMS were, again, available in only relatively limited numbers. I don't remember the exact size of the stockpile, but I seem to remember that it was, well, several thousands, but it was not vast. And the US, which has no alternative missile system to the ATACMS immediately available or in production, needed arguably to husband that stockpile. But the Biden administration, having taken the plunge and having decided to supply ATACMS missiles to Ukraine, eventually ended up sending 500 of those missiles to Ukraine, significantly depleting the stockpile. They did exactly the same, to an even greater extent, with Patriot missile interceptors. The Patriot missiles are arguably at least as important for the US military as Tomahawk missiles are. The inventory, again, is not big. There are demands for Patriot missiles in Israel and in the Far East and in other places. And yet, and nonetheless, and in spite of that, the United States has apparently supplied hundreds of Patriot missile interceptors to Ukraine, severely depleting the stockpile, putting the American military itself in a critical position, facing shortages of this extremely important weapon. Who can confidently say that events will not repeat themselves? The United States might initially tell the Ukrainians, we can only afford to give you 20 to 50 Tomahawks. But then, of course, those Tomahawks will be expended very quickly. Demands, as night follows day, from the Ukrainians will come for more and more. And more Tomahawks will be sent. And, of course, there will be steps taken to increase production. And production will indeed be increased, but never by as much as is needed to compensate for the running down of the inventory. And the inventory will continue to be run down, because when it comes to Zelensky and the Ukrainians, the Americans find it incredibly difficult to say no. There's always in Washington people who will lobby for more and more valuable and important weapons, weapons in short supply, to be sent. After all, hasn't this been also true in Europe? The Europeans and the Americans disposed of a staggeringly high proportion of their inventories of artillery shells. They continue to run down those inventories because even as they have increased production of artillery shells, demands from Ukraine for artillery shells continue and continue to increase. Several European armies, including, by the way, from what I've heard, the British, have basically given Ukraine practically their entire inventory of self-propelled guns. And notwithstanding all of this, notwithstanding the crisis in the inventories, people continue to give to Ukraine. But anyway, let's come back, however, to this Financial Times article, because I repeat again what I have said, what I've received, the information I've received from various, I consider, extremely reliable sources. The Tomahawk only works as a conventional weapon if it is used in clusters. The warhead is big, but it lacks penetration. The missile itself is large and relatively slow, and it is not stealthy. And in any attack, especially against the targets in Russia, large numbers of these missiles are likely to be shot down. So you would need a significant number of missiles in order to carry out a single effective strike. I have been told informally that you would need at least 100 missiles in one strike to be able to make significant damage, to have some hope of achieving significant damage on targets inside Russia. If all you can afford to supply is 20 to 50, then it makes absolutely no sense to supply them. This whole thing becomes not just illogical, as the Russian diplomat Miroshnik said, as I discussed in my program yesterday. It becomes not just illogical, it becomes frankly ridiculous. You are taking extraordinary threats, extraordinary risks with a strategic system, one which the Russians have warned cannot be distinguished from a nuclear system, one which is likely to infuriate and anger the Russians, and one which the Russians have already said, if it is supplied to Ukraine, will kill off any prospect for US-Russian détente or rapprochement or even dialogue. And you are going to do all of that to supply quantities of a missile, which even your own experts admit cannot change the outcome of the war. It is an extraordinary exercise in futility. Apparently, in Russia, this whole issue of the Tomahawk is being referred to as the Tomahawk hoax. I do not go that far. I think it is highly likely that sooner or later the United States is going to supply these systems. But all of this information, the information provided in this article by the Financial Times, shows us how illogical and ridiculous this whole thing is. Now, let's go back to those meetings in Brussels, because it doesn't look as if those meetings are going to come up with anything that remotely approximates to a plan. Supplying Tomahawks in dribbles also is not a plan. It is phenomenally dangerous and extremely reckless, but it is not a plan. And, well, just to get a sense of how chaotic decision making is in Europe at the present time, just look at what has just happened in Germany. The German government has been talking about increasing the size of the German army, the Bundeswehr, from 180,000 men to 260,000 men. A significant increase, but not a dramatic one. However, there is a problem in that young Germans don't seem to be at all keen on joining the Bundeswehr, and especially not at a time like this of international tensions and of potential war, in which they doubt the logic of joining up and risking their lives. So the members of Friedrich Merz's coalition, the CDU and the SPD, came together and they came up with an idea. It's not a plan, it is an idea. Firstly, they will increase financial packages to try to persuade young Germans to volunteer to join up in the Bundeswehr. But if this doesn't work, then they will conduct some kind of lottery, and young Germans who have not volunteered but who lose the lottery might face some kind of call-up, presumably at random. Now, this already seems to me to be an incredibly bad idea. I can see how it could lead to enormous objections and many protests within German society. But what makes this whole thing even more absurd is that the German Defence Minister, Boris Pistorius, who is, by the way, a hardliner on relations with Russia, apparently he wasn't consulted about this plan, and he has come out publicly and said that this is unworkable. So you come up with a plan to increase the size of your army, but you don't consult your defense minister. As an exercise in planning, this is absurd, but this is what we increasingly see in the West. And in the meantime, we have all kinds of crowing. The NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte, was bragging about how bad the Russian submarine fleet is. And he made all sorts of negative comments about a Russian submarine which supposedly was experiencing mechanical problems. He seemed to claim that this somehow proved something about the Russian Navy, or the Russian military, as if NATO militaries also don't suffer from problems too, mechanical problems too, just saying. But what makes it even more bizarre is it's not clear that there have been any problems with this submarine at all. The Russians say that there has been none, and I noticed that a commentator on the Daily Telegraph, Tom Sharp, a former Royal Navy officer, who, by the way, is outspokenly supportive of Ukraine. Anyway, he said that, as I write this, it's not clear whether or not this boat is in trouble. It apparently leaked fuel last month. Boats and ships do that. It has since headed home. They do that too. It was escorted on the way past Gibraltar by British patrol boats, by France through the Bay of Biscay, by HMS Iron Duke in the Channel, and now by the Dutch in the North Sea. 11 surface units from 6 partner nations have been involved. So far, so normal. To me, that looks like a massive open deployment of forces for what is supposed to be a broken down submarine. But anyway, and then he goes on to say the submarine has also spent much of its time on the surface. This is also normal for a boat of this kind. Diesel electric submarines are so called because they use both types of motor to propel themselves. The diesels can drive the boat directly or be used to charge up a big bank of batteries. The electric motors can run on battery power and the diesels can be shut down. And then he describes how, in practice, electric batteries are only used when the boats are underwater. And one doesn't use the diesels underwater except through a snorkel, and that there are problems using snorkels over long distances, especially in choppy seas, and that it is normal, therefore, given the short time before the batteries run out of power, for ships of this kind, but submarines of this kind, to operate on the surface where they can use their diesel engines and move on relatively fast power to whatever, wherever it is they want to go. And then he points out that, yes, it is true that the Russians have deployed a tugboat with them, have deployed a tugboat to operate with this submarine. But then he points out that this is what the Russians also normally do. We know that Russian vessels going far from home, ships or submarines, routinely deploy with fleet tugboats in attendance. Taking a tugboat with you is baffling behaviour to us and easy to mock, but it is quite normal for them. And in fact, he provides the reason, which is that the Russians don't have the enormous number of overseas bases that Western navies can call upon. And so it is sensible to have a tugboat nearby in case there is some kind of a breakdown and a ship needs help to repairs with repairs or needs to be towed. So NATO, Mark Rutte, bragging, it seems, over probably nothing at all. Now, I come back to my original point. There doesn't seem to be a plan here. There is no plan for how Ukraine can win the war. There's talk about supplying Tomahawks. Incredibly reckless and very dangerous, as I described in my program yesterday. Undermining, probably, President Putin's wish to maintain a dialogue with President Trump and the United States. And all to no purpose because, well, you might supply more than 20 or 50, probably many more than 20 or 50, but you will never supply enough to change the dynamic of the war. And meetings taking place in Brussels, but again, no real plan on what to do to win the war. And in the meantime, as I discussed at the beginning of this program, or through most of this program, the Russians clearly are working to a plan. Now, to repeat again a point I have made before, in any conflict situation that I am aware of, in fact, in most areas of life, it is those who have a plan and who stick to it who tend to win out against those who don't. Now, I don't think this is properly understood in the West. There is no plan, obviously, in the West, because there is no means to win for the West to win this war anymore. There continue to be crossed fingers that the Russian economy is going to collapse, but I have been reading reports this morning from the Russian Central Bank, and they feel that everything is going according to plan. And yes, the economy is slowing, but inflation is falling, and they are giving now clear hints that they're going to cut interest rates further when they meet again on the 24th of October. And they expect, in time, growth rates in Russia to start picking up again, though doing so against a backdrop of subdued inflation. So they don't seem to be worried about an economic crisis in Russia. And as I discussed in my program yesterday, the trade war between the United States and China, which is, by the way, now becoming increasingly angry and bitter, all but precludes any possibility that China is going to start cutting the Russians off in terms of exports of high technology or imports of Russian oil. So we are out of a plan. We have no plan. We haven't, in my opinion, in the West, had anything that really approximates to a plan since the defeat of Ukraine's summer offensive of 2023. The only viable plan is to negotiate, and to do so on the basis of what the Russians call the root causes. There is no other plan in existence than that which can possibly have any chance of success. It doesn't seem as if people in the West are prepared to admit it. So we come up with these disastrous schemes to supply Zelensky, of all people, with Tomahawk missiles. And we have all of these meetings, endless, continuous, repeated meetings, one meeting after another meeting, talking about the same topics again and again and again that we see taking place all the time in Europe. If there is a better example of a failure of statesmanship, I simply don't know what it is. Anyway, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar. Links under this video. Don't forget also, again, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. And last but not least, don't forget also to look up our shop. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.